thanks for joining us. You were Dinky Dawson.
So welcome to Two Pints in a Corner.
Yep, with Dinky Dawson, and I'm Tony Rain, and we have a special guest this morning, Peter Lembo, who had quite a history with the club from the day it opened, I think.
Well, yeah, 79, 80, something like that.
Oh, wow. Yep. That's when the Mad Hatter was, 79.
After it became the Channel.
Yeah,
right.
80.
And that lasted probably to the late 80s.
And when did you start with the Stompers? Because that was really your baby,
yeah,
right?
The Stompers were the first one. That was like 1980. And they were playing Monday night at the Rat for $25.
Oh, man.
And it cost them $24 to rent
the
trailer to get the gear there. So,
well, on Cape Cod, they're still playing for $25. And it's costing about $125 to play.
So that's how my whole relationship. I shared office space with Al Goldman in Harvard Square. So
you did? Oh,
so
cool.
I used to hang out at Jonathan Swift's all the time. And
Barbara Rhine?
Barbara, that's right.
Yeah.
And I love music. I love bands. And
yeah,
I saw some great acts there. And then little by little, I ended up moving to 25 Com Ave, my office with Frank Near. And then after that, I went to Alston, and I went into the same building as Tim Collins, who was Aerosmith's manager.
Right.
We hung out, and that's really when I started, you know, really loving to go to the Channel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just to go, even on my nights off, that was a place to go, to have a drink, and do business. You know, you could always go there. My lawyer would come down, we'd hang out, see a great group or a couple of great groups, search around looking for, you know, for local talent.
Yeah.
It was a great place to see what a young band could do on a big stage.
There's the scene.
That's what the word that we keep coming back to is the scene, and that's what Dinky and I both kind of grew up with in England, was that the clubs, and we keep bringing it up, the clubs used to be the draw more than the artists.
More than the, right.
You went because there was a scene there, and there was a good chance you'd see something good because it was quality. But you weren't going just to buy a ticket to see a headline band. I mean, a lot of that did happen later on, but for the most part, people went to the Channel because it was a good club.
And, you know, you always had three acts on the stage.
Yeah, you were
so
diverse.
Your chances of finding some, I mean, that's what I did. I was a personal manager, and my reason for being there, other than to hang out, you know, with friends, was to just see by chance, you hear a band with one good song, and you know you got something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go check it out.
And also, being able to hear them till 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And that was a big draw, the fact that you could get a drink till 2 o'clock.
You know, the funny thing is the Stompers always sold the club out. And then always on a Friday or Saturday night.
Yeah.
And I can remember, I was living in East Walpole at the time, and I can just remember having a suitcase full of cash, you know, from the week's draw from the band, in my car, you know, somewhere around 2:30 or 3 in the morning, driving home on the expressway with every freaking drunk from downtown.
Me too.
And all I kept saying to myself was, someday, I'm going to get creamed.
And Sal was probably still on the stage when we were trying to get him off.
I was trying to get him off.
At 3 o'clock in the morning.
That's what it was.
So who else did you manage besides the Stompers?
I did the Stompers. I did a blues soul singer who was very popular in Europe, Mighty Sam McClain. He was a friend of the Neville Brothers.
I did Sam McClain down in Mississippi a few years ago at a Robert Johnson Festival that I produced, and he was a guest on that.
He was a great guy, you know. Daryl Martini, the Cosmic Muffin from WWE. Daryl actually played the Channel himself as an MC.
Uh-huh.
Bobby Whitlock from Derek and
the Bobby,
who was Eric Clapton's partner and co-wrote all the songs on that album. Johnny A, who's still out and still playing.
Still
And Fahrenheit, Charlie and Dave.
Charlie. I worked with Charlie in the last few years.
Well, Bobby Whitlock was at the Narrows a few years ago, I think.
Bobby did a tour with his wife, just an acoustic tour, and he would hire a local guitar player.
Mm.
But what I did was I brought Bobby up here. They rehearsed at the John Messina's studio. I brought in all the great, not all, but certainly all great musicians. Johnny A was the guitar player. You know, all really good musicians put a band together. And Bobby played the channel like on a Monday night.
Yep.
And he did like 500 people.
I saw it on the book. And I ran into stuff with him. I spent 2 years down in Muscle Shoals. And he spent a long time down there. He worked Muscle Shoals sound.
He was a serious talent. He had a voice like nobody.
Mm.
We were, one night we went to, Al Goldman was running a restaurant over in Alston. And he had karaoke in the back room. So Al invited us over for dinner. So we went to dinner and Al said, come on back and have a drink in the bar. So we go in the bar, and it's karaoke. And there's all businessmen sitting there, and there's some guy on the stage trying to sing. He was the host of the karaoke night.
And
Bobby Whitlock is dead drunk. He's sitting at the bar. Bobby orders a drink, and he goes, I love that fucking teriyaki. I love teriyaki. And he's screaming at this guy. And everybody's looking at us at the bar. And I'm like, oh, please, stop, will ya? And I forget what song the guy was singing. But Bobby's voice was so strong, he stood up on the bar and sang the song with no microphone and drowned the guy out. And Bobby gets a standing ovation.
Wow.
I mean, it was just one of the funniest
nights.
That's
cool.
I take it back. It was a Brazilian steakhouse that Al, right near WBZ in Austin.
Nice.
Wow.
So,
that's cool.
We had some fun nights.
Yeah.
Those are the fun nights. That kind of stuff really gets to you.
And the Stompers lasted a long time in the channel as a headline. They were there for years.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't get in there till 85 as a bar manager. And they were,
when we decided to leave the Rat, and I said to myself, you know, people said, well, you can't go here, you can't go there. And I was like, why not? Why can't they play Bunreddy's? Why can't they play Jonathan Swift's?
Yeah.
So we went into those places and sold them out and totally changed the face of a folk music club in Swift's and a cover band club at Bunratty.
Right. Mm. Oh, yeah.
And then little by little, you know, when the channel came around and we sold the channel out on our first night to Don Laws being pissed off.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Because we were already
chagrin is the word we're looking for.
We were already selling out to Paradise. We were the second Boston original band to sell out the Paradise. The Cards were the first.
First one, okay.
Nice.
The Stompers have always been good. Sal has always been good and always will be.
Yep.
Our doctor for years.
Howard.
Howard Jones.
Sal Baglio, Tim.
Yeah.
And they played down here. I mean, you always were at
The Compass in
Dallas, which is a CVS now.
Yeah.
Is it really?
That's sad.
It's
a cold place.
And they used to switch off the Stompers and the Fools all summer long. Yeah.
Well, we played every Monday.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you a funny story. One Monday, we ended up at a college out in the western part of the state. And the club said, why don't you come here and play on Monday night? And they offered us a lot of money. So I had to call Murph, who I understand is still around down here doing real estate. But we had to call Murph and say, look, we can't play, you know, whatever the day was that Monday.
Yeah.
So we ended up getting Robin Lane and the Chalkbusters to fill in. We were all booked by Howie Cusack.
Yep.
So Howie just put Robin in there to play. Now, Robin's road manager calls
It's all right, go ahead.
Calls, well, musical
calls Murph and says, we need to load in at 3 o'clock. And Murph goes, 3 o'clock? I'll be there at 5. And the tour manager goes, no, no, you don't understand. We got to load the gear in. And he goes, yeah, the Stompers load the gear in. They come at 5. You can come at 5. He's going, no, no, you don't understand. I understand perfectly, okay? Well, we're going to be there at 3, and if, you know, this doesn't happen, we may not play. He goes, good, I won't pay you. So, of course, the gear shows up at 3 o'clock. Murph shows up at 5 o'clock. They're pissed off. They're having a big fight. The gear's all out of the truck. And Murph just goes, do you want to play or not? All right, we'll set up. Robin's not here yet. Everything's cool. These guys were deathly afraid of Robin Lane, right? So they set the gear up, and the guy goes, okay, where's the crew food? And Murph goes, crew food? What are you talking about? I don't feed musicians. Well, it's in the rider. I didn't read the rider. I don't feed musicians. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? He said, look, the Stompers play every Monday night. They go across the street to the Chinese restaurant, and they eat, and they pay for their own dinner. And you're going to do the same thing. Now, the fight's getting worse and worse and worse. And the guy says, look, I can cover for the crew. I'm not sure I can cover for the band, but I definitely can't cover for the dog. And Murph goes, what effing dog? Robin has a dog with her, and you've got to provide a can of Alpo. And Murph goes, I'm not feeding the crew. And if I'm not feeding the band, and I'm not feeding Robin Lane, I sure as hell ain't feeding no goddamn dog. Long story short, the band shows up.
Yeah.
Okay. She's outside. They go eat. Now, the crew guys goes, we need dog food. And Murph goes, I bought a can of dog food. It's in the dressing room, which was the kitchen. And I bought some crackers for you guys to eat. Well, he had taken the Alpo, put it on the crackers, and the crew had eaten the dog food.
That's a good one.
Robin comes back.
Pate.
Robin comes back, and Murph goes and goes, I fed the damn dog. I don't know where the food went. He puts his hand in the trash barrel and pulls out the empty can of Alpo.
Oh, my God.
To make this story even worse, I'm in L.A., okay, and I'm with my friend Jeffrey Foskett from the Beach Boys. Now, Jeffrey was a big Stompers fan. He and Billy Hinchy and a lot of the – in fact, they played at the Channel when Sal played.
Right.
And they played at the Beachcomber in Quincy when Sal played.
Yeah.
So they were big fans. And we're having a conversation. We're on the beach, just walking around. And he goes, I heard this story about Robin Lane. And he didn't know it was me, that I knew the story, that I had started the story. The story went all across the country, from musician to musician to musician to musician.
Nice.
Classic.
And her crew ate dog food.
Nice. Oh, my God.
We have to mention that to Tim Jackson next time we see him.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. That's a good one, Peter. I like that
That's
one.
That's hilarious.
Those are the fun stories, that stuff.
That's crazy
stuff. It's so funny, as we were talking about before we went on air here, you know, there were so many bad stories.
Oh, yeah.
But some of the good stories were just so funny. They outdid, you know, all the bad stories.
I did something similar when I was Sleepy LaBeef, which I never really regretted because he deserved it that night. But
he was great.
I was doing Sleepy at the Wayside Inn in Chatham in the winter. And, you know, he had these pickup bands.
Yeah.
That weren't very experienced. Yeah. They were pretty bad.
I figured they all knew the song.
Well, and I used to say the same thing as Murph. I'd say load in at 5 o'clock, or I'd ask him to load in at 3 o'clock, set the stage, and then give him dinner. So as people came in, they saw the room was ready. These kids show up at 5 o'clock. One of them's underage. They've got gear all over the restaurant, and I'm trying to home for dinner, and I'm getting more and more ticked off about the whole thing. So Sleepy shows up, and he and I had been friends. We'd done some shows. And I start giving him grief about the band. And, you know, you're paying him nothing. And I knew what he's...
Yeah.
I knew what Sleepy's game was. Pick up some local kids on the Cape, they'll play, and nobody will know the difference.
Yeah. Everybody gets 50 bucks.
It's rockabilly. It's three chords, you know. Yeah. They're all good. And,
just tell me what key.
Yeah, right. So I'm giving him grief, and then he decides to get on stage and start giving me a hard time because I'd been busting his chops. And he's complaining about the sound and blah, blah, blah. And he was in that old board of dinkies, and I've got stuff going on. And I'm sucking it up, and it starts snowing. And Sleepy had this huge Cadillac he used to drive, parked out from the wayside. It starts snowing, and I'm watching it snow and snow and snow. And I kept him waiting to get paid. We closed at 12. I had him there till about 2 o'clock, till the snow was about 2 feet deep around his car. And then I paid him and threw him out. I never saw him again after that. But he used to do those. I mean, those were head games back then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But,
like we talked about when you know, before cell phones, when tour managers used to come in and just try to steal your phone line.
Yeah.
To advance all the shows, to make all their long distance calls on your dime.
On business
lines. On your dime,
all the time.
Was there a pecking order among the Boston bands? Like I was always either in Plymouth or on the Cape, but I always thought of the Stompers as kind of the, almost like the quintessential Boston band.
Yeah, I think they were.
And like were they sort of? I mean, I know the Cars and Aerosmith and all that, but I mean, as far as Boston bands,
well, they
were they the cream of the crop?
The Fools, you know, the Neighborhoods to some degree a little later on. But I think we were one of the first bands to get signed. We got signed to Boardwalk Records, which was Joan Jett's label.
Yeah.
And we put our Stompers album came out in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And we were 81 with a bullet.
Yeah.
And as funny things would have it, number 80 was Carl Wilson from the Beach Boys. And we ended up co-headlining at the casino in Hampton Beach with Carl. And Sal was one of those people. He was a huge Beach Boy fan. And he refused to talk to Carl. Carl wanted us to headline because the place was sold out. There were 1,700 people there. There were Stompers fans. People didn't even know who Carl Wilson was.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow.
My friend Billy Hinchey was playing keyboards for him. I met Billy that night, actually, who later became one of my dear friends. And Carl came in and he said, look, you know, I don't really know much, but all I hear is what's going on with the band. And why don't you guys close the show?
Uh-huh.
And I said, absolutely not. We're going to open the show. This is a favor to the owner, Jim Goodwin, who's a dear, dear friend. Trust me, nobody is going to leave. And poor Carl was, you know, just, I don't want to go on to an empty house. If these people leave, don't worry. To Sal's credit, he did his regular show. Not the two-hour version, but he did the 75-minute version.
Yeah.
And the last thing he said was, our friend, who we'd never met, Carl Wilson, is coming up next from the Beach Boys. If anybody leaves, don't ever come to another Stompers show. And everybody sat in their seats.
Cool.
And Carl did his show. From that day on, Carl and I became dear, dear friends.
Yeah, you would.
And in fact, his tour manager, who was one of Elvis's Memphis Mafia, called me at midnight. I'm home thinking it's the band on the road. I wake up, and it's Carl and the tour manager, and they're in Minnesota. This guy was married to Myrna Smith, who was Elvis's female backup singer of the Sweet Inspirations.
Yeah.
Her ex-husband had stolen this car that Elvis bought for Myrna Smith. And he wanted it back. And I decided that maybe Carl could help me find somebody who would buy it. And the first name that came up was you. And I said, I'll buy it. So, well, we have to get it off the used car lot. He's selling it. But I think I can arrange that. But here's the deal. I'll sell you the car when it gets to your house. I had it shipped to my office. He said, just send me a check and promise me you will never make money. I'm so sick of people making money off of Elvis's name or his property.
Yeah.
Whatever you put into the car, you can add on for repairs and stuff if you have to sell it. But please, you know. So I had the car shipped to my office in Alston. The Aerosmith guys were there meeting with Tim Collins, who was in the same building. And nobody could believe that Elvis's baby blue Eldorado had just shown up in Alston. So everybody wanted a ride,
of course.
There's no plates on it, and we're driving around, right?
That's you.
So I kept that car for several years, but unfortunately, I didn't have a garage, and the car started to get the effects of New England winters.
Oh, yeah.
And I sold it to somebody under the same conditions and found out he had the car in a dealership for $130,000.
Yeah, I believe it.
And needless to say, that fellow and I are not friends anymore.
No, I don't.
But that really ticked me off, you know. But that was just one of those weird side things.
Yeah.
So cool.
That happened by osmosis.
Yeah.
You know, somehow. And I think about, I mean, you know, you think about the channel and all the camaraderie we had, all the people we met, you know. And you think about the people that came into town, like these Beach Boys guys, who they wanted to go to the channel because that's the club they heard about, you know. Yeah. It wasn't the Lansdowne Street, Don Walker. It was the channel.
Yeah.
That was like the people's club, if for lack of a better phrase.
Exactly.
And, you know, all those guys came and hung out. It was just a place to go. I mean, rather than meet my lawyer in his office on Federal Street, we met at the channel and had a couple of drinks and talked about whatever we had to talk about, you know?
Makes sense.
So it was a good place for music. It was a good place to drink. It was a good place to pick up girls. Sorry, honey. And it was a good place to do business.
I think you buried the lead.
Yeah, well. If I don't answer the phone tomorrow, Dinky, you'll know why. So anyways, you know, it was just the perfect music room in Boston.
Yeah.
I just had some really fun nights there, you know. We had some great times.
What was your best night that you could think of?
The best night at the channel?
Yes, for you.
Well, I'm going to have to give you three.
Okay.
One of them was, of course, Roy Orbison.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Who I stage managed for Al Goldman. I stage managed Roy four or five times at different venues for Al Goldman.
Yeah.
Because one night, his stage manager just wasn't available. But Roy came in and played Jonathan Swift's when I was sharing office space with him. And when his brother came in, who was his tour manager, saw the club, he said, we're not playing here. I mean, it was only, 100 people, 150 people?
Yeah.
We're not playing here. And Al freaked out, and he said to me, can you go over and talk to this guy? I got to save the show. I got two sold-out shows, you know. So, of course, Roy is staying in a motel in Watertown.
Yeah.
You know. So I got on and I meet his brother, who was a sheriff, a southern sheriff.
Oh.
And he's just started barking at me.
Yeah.
And I said, look, you know, I'm in the music business. I manage talent. This is what I do. You know, I just happened to share office space with Mr. Goldman, who is probably the most honorable person. Yeah. And I'm telling you this, and if I'm wrong, I'll pay you out of my pocket. That's how sure I am, excuse me, that this is going to work.
Yeah.
Next, you know, we're going to go to a bigger room than maybe the Berkeley Performance Center, which we did. He's going to put Roy back on the map in Boston. And the funny thing is, after Roy's heart attack, when he had kind of retired, he came back and he played a big, huge tent for Ronald Reagan. He was a big Republican Reagan supporter. And that's how we knew he was back on the road. So as things turned out, Roy played Swifts. He and I became great friends.
Yeah.
So when he came to the channel, that was a couple times he played the channel, but I was there two nights before he died.
Yeah,
you know?
So
Roy, you know, definitely was one of those people. The other two people you may have heard of, but most people listening to this won't know, but it was Pentangle.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a huge Burt Jantz and John Renbourn fan. And I actually got to hang out with those guys before the show at Soundcheck. And I couldn't believe I was sitting there talking to Burt Jantz, who I truly adored, having been a folkie in my younger days. And that was a great night.
Yeah.
And the third night I have to put up there, well, I'm going to have to add one. The third night I'll put up there was B.B. King.
Oh, yeah.
I was sitting in the office with his guitar, Lucille.
Yeah.
B.B. was eating fruit because he was a diabetic.
Yeah.
As was I. And we started talking, and he said to me, "You ain't no guitar player." And I said, "You're right, I am not a guitar player." He goes, no, that's not what I mean. The radio goes off and the tour manager goes, "The limo is coming to pick up Lucille." They sent the car from backstage to the office door to pick up his guitar. And he says to me, "If you were a guitar player, you would ask me, you'd say, 'BB, can I play Lucille?'" And I said, "Absolutely not. I, you know, I'm thinking to myself, all I got to do is drop this Gibson guitar and break the neck off, you know." He says, "Just play an E chord. Let me know you're not lying to me." So I picked Lucille up off the guitar stand, and I got to play an E chord on Lucille.
Wow.
Just as the road crew comes in to take Lucille to the stage, man. Which was a rush. And I'll give you a fourth one, which was an odd night. But having grown up a huge Birds fan, and I know that your involvement with the Birds, in 85, Gene Clark and Mike Clark from the original five members of the Birds came with an absolute all-star band. There were very few people there, but I had more fun listening to every song. Gene Clark was the primary songwriter. In the Birds.
Oh, yeah.
And he did all of his songs. For anybody that bought 45s back in those days will note that there was always the hit single on the A side, and there was a Gene Clark written song on the B side.
Oh, really?
And he played all of those B side songs, which I loved, and that warmed my heart.
Yeah.
And when he introduced the band and you realize there were all of these, Sneaky Pete was playing pedal steel, all these cool...
Pete Lino,
of these
you
big
know,
cool...
That's Gumby.
Oh, really?
He did Gumby.
Really?
Yeah. Pete used to walk around New York City and get his inspiration as soon as he got off a plane. And when he was playing with the Burrito Brothers.
Wow.
Yeah, he's the guy that drew Gumby and made Gumby.
I didn't realize that.
That's funny.
So those were really the four great nights that other than seeing my own acts up on that stage, that was the four nights I will never forget as long as I live. And the great thing about the channel was you get to meet these guys. You know, there was no pomposity about
no.
backstage, don't go no. here, don't go there. You know, you got to the point where not only were these guys special because you heard them on the radio and you bought their recordings, but you got to realize they were human beings.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
And they did everything you did. You know? Yeah. I mean, and it was a great feeling, not only as being, you know, a personal manager of talent, but just being a music fan.
Yeah.
You know, to meet these guys that you idolized, you know, in your younger days, and realize that they're just wonderful people, you know?
Especially when they're touring. They're all good when they're touring.
Most of them is good, yeah.
Most of them are good when they're touring. It's just getting them at home can be a very different little affair.
Well, I never let my fandom go away. And in fact, I was interviewed for the Boston Globe and came out on the front page of the calendar section back in 83 or 84. And the one quote that I was proudest about was I think it was Ted Drzowski, actually, from the Globe. And I just said, if I ever lose my sense of love of the music, I'll quit. And that's exactly what happened.
Well, that's what it's all about. That's come up in our conversations a lot.
It really has.
And the people, Tim's been watching it, the people that are in it for the music.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like you're in it for the money. I mean, blessed in that my acts made money. I could afford a staff. I could afford office space, you know.
Well, I think we're all lucky. I say that a lot to Tim. We're lucky to have made a living doing what we love.
Exactly right.
When we were kids, and I appreciate that. And I think a lot of it's gone away now because a lot of the new stuff,
it's all different.
They're only looking for fame. Yeah. They don't want a guy's not happy just to be playing guitar because he loves to play guitar. He wants to be famous.
Well, after I left the music business, I actually went to work doing big events for Northeastern University.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my brother was the vice president of Northeastern, and so I had gone to all the hockey games and all that stuff. So I knew the people that I was working with on a social level. Well, when I first had to go in there to work, these friends became my co-workers.
Yeah.
And so after work, you know, over a beer, everybody would say, what was it really like? I mean, the girls, the shows, meeting these people. And, you know, I would sit there and go, I had to give everybody the C and D versions of these stories. Because if I had given them the A and B versions, they would have either kicked my ass, thrown me out, or not believe a word I said. You just had to sit down and sort of, you know, make everything a little bit nicer than it really was.
Because that's what they want to hear.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had 29 years in the tent there with all those acts coming through.
Yeah.
They all want to know about, you must know this guy. You must know that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I knew him well enough to walk him across the street from the hotel and make sure his lunch was ready. And I could tell you, I know his tour manager and his bus driver better than I know him.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. You know.
I knew more drivers.
Yeah.
Than celebrities, because the same drivers would come in a few times.
Yeah. Oh, what a world. I don't know. And we all survived, man. That's the incredible part of this.
Well, it's nice we're sitting here talking about it, you know, and it's changed. I'm not going to say it's a lost world, but when you hear the news about Live Nation and Ticketmaster and everything, it's just corporate, the business is being run by bean counters. There's very little creative in it anymore, I find. It's formula.
It's done.
You know? Mm-hmm.
I mean, the songwriting's all formula now.
Everything's formula.
The production's all formula.
Right. It's all computer generated. Well,
The ends of it, like Dinky's End with the audio, when, you know, it was Wild West when you were on the road, you'd have to go into a club and troubleshoot the sound system. To get it up and running.
Well,
now,
I can remember.
Now they've all got the same gear.
I can remember sitting in the studio, down in Syosset, Long Island, two stories from that era, but we had Richie Cordell producing and Glenn Clark in engineering. And Sal couldn't hit a note. There was one note that was way up top, and Sal couldn't hit it. And I will never forget this as long as I live. Richie said, "Get the hell out of there, Sal." And he walked into the studio, and he crept down with the headphones on, sort of in a crouching position. Glenn played back the song, and as soon as that note came, he came up untwirled like a snake and hit that note right on with his high tenor voice. And today, I mean, if you listen to that song on the Stompers record, you would never know.
You don't know that's been dubbed it. Yeah.
So
nice.
I don't
that's
know.
Good.
Well, they can do that, but today you can actually don't even have to sing it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, exactly.
You can use Pro Tools and mess around.
Exactly, back
I mean,
then.
That's not real. To me, I have to be real. That's why I love live.
I agree.
Right.
You know, and that's why, I mean, you can see, I can see him now, Sal spinning around and doing a guitar lick and then coming back to the, you know, as part of the energy.
Yeah.
The feel. And you can get that captured on tape.
Yeah.
And the live. Energy makes your voice better.
Live is yeah. Live, there's a live and live is live.
Live is live.
It's like theater and television. It's
We had a guy in the studio in Syosset that came in and just didn't knock. Came in, sat down. It's like, who the hell is this guy? You know? And Richie had just got done working with the Ramones. And the Ramones had just been produced by Phil Spector. And they would work all day on one fade.
Yeah.
And somebody would walk in, and Spector would nix the entire thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And start all over again the next day. So yeah. I'm thinking of this, because Richie and Glenn were telling Ramone stories that were horrifying. And in walks this guy, and he sits down, and Richie starts talking to him. Well, it turns out he was one of the original members of Jay and the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, Walter O'Donnell.
And I said, you know, wow, I'm impressed, you know. So we start talking, and I said, I'm a big fan. I introduced myself. And decided to take a break, and we're in the lounge area. And the guy picks up the phone, he dials a number. And he goes, "Hey, Lembo, it's for you." I said, "For me? What the hell is it?" He goes, "Answer the phone." So I say, "Hello. It's Jay Black on the other end of the phone." And I'm like, I mean, what do you say to Jay Black, you know? And this is 1983, of course, you know. And I'm like, holy cow. And when I look back, two things I remember from that recording sessions. Number one, we hung out with Gary U.S. Barnes, who fell asleep on the floor in my hotel room because he was so drunk.
Yeah.
But a great guy and a great hang, and that phone call with Jay Black. I think I remember that stuff more than I remember the actual recording process.
Yeah. Nice.
And we had done local, you know, we had done local tapes at different studios and worked with some, you know, some great Boston guys.
Yeah.
But, you know, being in Long Island and working with, you know, Richie Cordell, who your listeners might know, he wrote "I Think We're Alone Now."
I think I'm a clown now.
He wrote "Moni." He wrote "Moni Moni."
Yep.
And I'll give you one quick Richie Cordell story. I made the mistake of asking him how he wrote "Moni Moni." Now, if you listen to Tommy James tell this story, it's a very homogenized, cleaned-up version, and it's all a lie. Okay. Richie liked to imbibe with vodka and soda. So he's walking around Manhattan. He lived in Greenwich Village, and he's stone drunk. And he doesn't remember anything. He has no concept of where he was, how he got home. He actually he bought a condo in a house that was owned by Thomas Edison, which a guy eventually bought from him for 4 times what he paid for it turn it into a museum. But Richie woke up with this blazing headache in the middle of the night, not remembering where he'd been, what he did, or how the hell he got home. And he got up and he, you know, got a glass of water or orange juice, and he's sitting at his kitchen table and he's got a pad and he starts writing because the memory is now coming back. He's so drunk, he passes out in a gutter on the sidewalk. And the last thing he remembers is standing in front of a Mutual of New York sign in the window. And it's blinking off. M-O-N-Y. M-O-N-Y. And that's how Moni Moni was
Moni
written.
Moni came
he
from.
He wrote that song in 5 minutes. Wow. And if you listen to the lines, the lyric, he stole every lyric from somebody else's song.
Right. Oh, sure.
And he just wrote the Moni Moni thing.
Yeah.
And now he's got a million-selling record with Tommy James and the Shondells.
Right. That's why there's so many Tonys in America, right? Because it was, they all came off the boat with two New York on their, on their passes.
Hey, my middle name is Tony, so I'm
that's
right.
That's why there's
I'm
a lot
right
of Tonys.
There, you know? So I don't know. You know, you start thinking. I haven't thought about a lot of this stuff in a lot of years, but this is just it's funny. Sitting back and thinking of all this
it's
stuff.
Fun stuff. It's good. The fun stuff is good.
I had some good conversations with Tommy James over the years. Interesting guy. And then that gets into the big Boston connection, doesn't it? When Strawberry's Records and
that
was all.
That's what happened. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
If you look at
Major Richie, Minor Records,
if
was
you
all
look
that
at
company.
Richie's songs,
mm-hmm.
he wrote all the songs from start to finish.
Yeah.
There were four writers on the song. Tommy James, what the hell was the guy's name that owned Strawberries?
What was Strawberries? Who was the guy who vanished?
Went Australia.
Supposedly. I'm gone. It'll come to
with
me.
With the empty casket.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
The third writer was Richie Cordell.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And the fourth writer was that guy's four-year-old son.
Oh, yeah, yeah, because the royalties
he's
were going
royalties,
in.
Royalties, right. Talk about crooks.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So I'm in New York with Charlie Farron, and Charlie Farron, Fahrenheit, is showcasing, what was the big punk club in New York? My memory.
CBGB's,
yeah. Right? Now, Charlie's used to playing really nice Boston clubs in the dressing room. Well, CBGB's was probably the biggest dump I've ever... It was nothing more than a big urinal, okay?
Yeah.
So Charlie gets on. I've got, I don't know, I think six record companies there. One of them, we were telling everybody was a little younger than they really were. And one guy is sitting there going, isn't that David Howell playing bass? And I said, yeah. He goes, I saw him at my high school graduation. He played in the Dirty Angels in Connecticut. So don't tell me he's, you know, 22 years old. He's... 38, right? But what are you going to do? Anyways, Richie comes. Can't stand Fahrenheit. And I got a guy from BMI, the music company. Charlie, I think, was an ASCAP writer, as were most of my clients. Richie can't stand the band. This isn't my thing. I'm saying, geez, if I could get Richie to agree to produce the band, that might help me get Charlie another deal, right? So Richie just says, the hell with this. Well, the guy from BMI, he was a kid. This is when, you remember the Mazda Miata, when you couldn't get them? I mean, they were, when they first came out, they were all red.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, Richie said to this guy, he tells him the whole story about all of his songs being co-written by a four-year-old and, you know, all these guys that had nothing to do with his writing.
Morris Levy.
Morris Levy,
thank you very much. Yeah.
Good man. So Richie says to the guy, if you can get my publishing back, I will give you anything you want. And the guy goes, well, what I want, you can't get me because I want a Miata. Richie goes, done. And I'm saying, how is this kid? He's only been working for BMI for months, right? How is this? So Richie and the guy leave because Richie can't stand Charlie Farron, which pissed me off, but that's a whole different story. Next thing I know, 6-8 months later, Richie calls me and goes, Lim, I got all my publishing back, and I'm having all these names taken off the songs. It's going to be Cordell, whose real name, by the way, was Richie Rosenblatt, and his best friend was Paul Simon. He and Paul Simon one day as kids broke into their synagogue. You guys may know that the rabbi goes around and unrolls the giant Torah. Well, that Saturday morning, rabbi went around with the Torah and blessed the Torah, and they opened the Torah to the audience, there was this huge picture of Elvis Presley in there that Richie and Paul Simon had put in there. I was a young boy listening to probably WMEX, and I hear this song that I fall in love with, and it's done by Richie Cordell. Nobody could get the record. He came up here and did a sock hop for all you older people, just mouthing that one song, and never happened. His recording career, he wanted to have a name like Bobby Rydell, which is why he came up with Cordell. And I always wanted that record, and I never got it. And when I first met Richie, my lawyer said to me, you can't handle, my lawyer represented Richie as well. He said, you can't handle this guy. You're too new, you know. I said, let me handle him. No, you can't. I said, let me just talk to him. I will get him to produce this record. And, of course, Richie and I get on the phone. Never met him. He's snarling. He's not very friendly. And I'm like, what did you do, you know, before? I wrote songs. I said, well, yeah, what songs did you write? I said, well, I wrote Moni Moni. I Think We're Alone Now. And, you know, they were all multi-million dollar hits. I said, yeah, what'd you do before that? And he goes, what are you talking about? I didn't do anything before that. I started singing the song that he had recorded in 1961, and he dropped the telephone, and he said, okay, I'm in. I'll produce your band. Never heard them, didn't know who they were.
Wow, how cool.
And that's how Richie Cordell produced the Stompers records.
Nice.
And he bought the kid Miata.
Yep.
And he bought the kid a Miata.
Yeah.
Now, and I never asked him, how did you get the car? He had it delivered to the guy's driveway in Connecticut. And,
nice.
I to this day, Richie's gone now, but, you know, if I ever had 2 minutes with Richie Cordell, I would say, how the hell did you get that? I mean, there were like 2 years' waits on getting that car, you know?
Well, we all know how Morris Levy got his.
He's probably buried in the trunk of it. Wow, Morris Levy. Morris owned a farm.
Did you deal with him at all?
Well, my lawyer was hated. When Boardwalk went under, actually, the funny story is the day Boardwalk filed bankruptcy, Sal's doing the Paradise. And instead of doing Under the Boardwalk, he changes it to Boardwalk's Gone Under. Now, nobody in the audience got it, but I was sitting there pissing my pants laughing because it was freaking hilarious. We were all in really bad moods, obviously. Yeah. Well, Boardwalk's catalog ended up getting bought by Mercury Records. So the guy who bought the contract subbed it out to Mercury and said, okay, we're gonna record one or two more songs, but we're gonna put the same album out because it never got a chance to sell. So I met with him, his name was Jeff Franklin. And I met with him in his office. It was the coolest office I ever saw. When you walked in, there was a full bar with bar seats. Then when you went to the middle of the office, there was a wraparound couch with a coffee table, like a little conference room. Then when you went to the end of the office, you had to step up, and he had his desk there. And I'm like, wow, this is impressive. And all he kept trying to do was get me to dump my lawyer, who I loved. I mean, Paul Schindler, you know, he was just a great lawyer, and he hated Paul because he had dated Paul's wife, who had been his secretary. And that was my first real training into the ins and the outs of the music business that have absolutely nothing to do with music. But your whole freaking career is sitting on who slept with who and why he hates your lawyer.
Right.
But he now owns your band. What the hell do you do? You know? So I don't know. I think about some of this stuff, and
it's great.
How you get through all this stuff is amazing. Which, you know, getting back to the channel story, makes some of those nights at the channel all the more worthwhile, because you realized it was really, when you cut through everything, it was really all about the music.
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. See, that's the whole thing. It's all about the music. That's why I went there in the long run, because I was retiring the system after, 10, 12 years.
And that was the best sound system in Boston. It was probably the best sound system in New England.
It was made for hi-fi. I made it as a giant stereo in 1972.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it went around the world. Steely Dan, Lou Reed, Mahavishnu.
Kinks.
Joan Baez, Birds, everybody had gone through that one.
Yeah.
And the quality. I did Sing Sing Prison with B.B. King and Voices.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Wasn't there something related to the electric chair with P.B. King?
The Sun News article. Joan Baez gets electric in jail. I had to hook into the power for the electric chair from the electric chair.
From the sound system.
Just from the sound system and lights. I took in two 16-track 2-inch.
What a great story.
I know. Two 16-track 2-inch. You have no idea. I'm in there with all these characters and stuff, and the electrician is in there for murder, and he's got the keys and he's running around with the keys and what have you. We go into the toilets, and there's a room in there, and they're all doing coke, and, these are prisoners and whatever. And he says, I'm not leaving this place. He says, I should have left 10 years ago. He says, because they'll kill me on the street, because I kill somebody on the street, they're going to kill me. So he
was safer in prison than he was out
in prison. Yeah. Doing electric, he had his own keys, he'd run around and whatever. But we did have to physically hook into where the power came in for the electric chair, because everything else was DC. So, it's that old. BB said it's his best gig he ever did. And I did a lot of tour with BB. With Fleetwood Mac, and he worked with me in England. I took him through all England.
But that foretells a great story that we've all been through.
Yeah.
How many times are you somewhere you've never been before, and you have to be so creative to make the show work?
Mm.
Think on your feet.
I mean, creative. I'm there with my partner. I've got my hat on, and I'm like, oh, shit. There's a joint in there. You have to be creative to do this. And it was Sing Sing Prison. It was on PBS on Channel 2 for Thanksgiving with Joan and stuff. And we had a great time. I enjoyed it. Although my partner ran away after that. He couldn't take any more of this, what I was doing. It was so different to his life.
Wow.
Selling buttons.
Dinky told me that story I interviewed Dinky about 45 years ago, and I still remember the B.B. King story. That's why I had to throw that out.
At the same time, the end of 79, during 79, I thought the music business changed then, because the audience was getting more anesthetized than the bands.
Yes.
And they were dying. When I went to Florida, I had Ambrosia out, and we were opening for Doobies, old friends of mine, and the Doobies and what have you. And they didn't want to go on because the people were dying in the actual venue from overdose,
coke
and stuff. So it was more to do with the show of the people than those lot on stage. So we went up and just played like stiff upper lip kind of thing, and just had a great old time and played. And I was so glad to get out. It's Hollywood, Florida. I was so glad to get out of that place. It was unbelievable.
Hmm.
It was, and that's when I said, that's it. And as Ambrosia's playing, I said, okay, we'll do the rest of these shows. Well, in the meantime, I get a call to take B.B. King to Russia.
Wow.
So I've already done a bunch of stuff with BB and stuff with Sid Seidenberg, and I just loved it.
Really nice people, great thing.
But I wanted to do this Ambrosia because we've got a number one album, a number one song, How Much I Feel, and this, that, and the other, and we were doing it with Little River Band at that time. So what I did is I got two lads from Boston who worked for me, Larry Wineless and Brad Berger, who Brad Berger's at the Performance Berkeley. Center right now. He's been teaching.
He's retired.
He's retired now.
From Berkeley, right? From
Berkeley. But them two went to Russia with all the gear. I got PV tobaccos and this, that, and the other, and what have you, and amps and guitars and all kinds of stuff for BB and whatever. Sent them to Russia. They went there. They could put the money on the table. They could put whatever their wallet. They would never get touched. But you told me about my wheels for my cases. They just ripped them all off. And any army strap that they could get their hand on, because we were doing cases with the army straps. They took all my army straps. They took all the wheels and stuff like that.
Wow.
But you could put your money out and you could.
No one touch it.
No one just. And it, with them being Russian Jewish kids, because they were talking Yiddish and British Russian over there, they got anything they want. Them guys, Larry and Brad, and you know,
they could trade it like kings over there.
Exactly, BB was loving it. He was just
I'll tell you a funny Russian story that involves the channel. I don't know if you guys were around. But there was a Russian band. Autograph.
Autograph. They were good.
Who played, well, let me finish my story here, Dink. They're playing the channel, and I said, just I want to hear what these guys are like. If you remember, they had crew members that were really nothing more than KGB agents with them.
Yeah.
I studied Russian for 4 years in high school.
Oh, there you go.
And 3 years in college.
There you go.
So I said, geez, a Russian band. I can't wait to hear these guys. I had no idea about it. It was just a curiosity.
Yeah.
So I go up to the guys and I say, Slasvich, как вы поживаете сегодня? These guys looked at me and grabbed me and took me to the back of the room and went to, I think, Peter Boris and said, get this effing guy out of here right now. In wonderful English, I might add. I was like, I'm just here to see the show, you know? And they were like, no, this person, he goes away, you know? And I'm like, what is wrong with you? So I ended up going in the office with Peter and waiting until the show started. Then I came out to see the band. But I'm like going, you know, did I do something wrong here? And in talking to people who knew better than I, these guys were meant to protect the band.
Yeah.
No interviews.
Yeah.
Because all of these guys were using their touring to escape the Soviets and come to America. And these guys, nobody talks to the band, especially if you happen to speak Russian.
Yeah.
They didn't want to hear about this whatsoever because the band didn't speak English.
Yeah.
But that was like a case of international relations at the channel. You know?
Wow. Yeah, they were good, though. They were enjoyable.
They were great. They were good
really
band.
Nice show on.
Yeah, they were good guys, I think.
Well, I mean, the performance was good. The playing was good. The entertaining.
And it was an interesting idea, you know. I mean, when you think about the variety of things that went on and off of that stage, to have a Russian pop band, you know, playing was just, it was unheard of.
So much stuff we talked about. I understand the Neubauten the other week, German band that came in one time. No instruments, no gear. They went to the dump. They came back with shopping carts, busted up kitchen equipment, pipes.
Well, I missed this one.
Put everything on the stage, mic'd it all up. I'm just playing all this junk.
Holy
cow. And that's how they did the shows every day.
Wow.
There was so much interesting
stuff. That's great. I wish I had seen that one.
So many interesting stuff that came through on many levels.
Loads of them.
You know?
Did you? We talk about the Wheels. One of my favorite bands ever was the Dred Zeppelin thing. That was always a killer.
Oh yeah, remember that? Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah,
with Mojo Nixon and Dred Zeppelin and the reggae Led Zeppelin songs with a fat Elvis lead singer.
Oh, that's right.
and the bass player was called Ja Paul Jones.
The
Channel had some very interesting nights there, far more than most other venues.
And if you want to see Sal Baglio, who we've been talking about so much, we have a picture of Sal in his Channel t-shirt that I took a couple of years ago with Tom Hembridge.
Yeah.
I was down there at 10.
I put him in Channel shirts and took pictures.
That's great.
For the website.
That was the last time I think I saw him. No, I think we had lunch once after that.
Yeah, we actually after that, yeah.
But it's funny, you know, you people listening will have to understand that the three of us have known each other for 140 years. When you think about the music business, it was a small circle of people.
Right.
And it was all between the bands and the managers. You know, there was always this sense of competition.
Yeah.
You know, the Fools, John Butcher, the Stompers. I mean, everybody was trying to sort of climb over everybody else. My theory always was, you know what, everybody mind your own business and we'll take care of our business.
Right.
You know, which is why, like...
But there was always a connection that we were all part of one.
Exactly.
Scene in Boston.
Exactly.
We all knew the same
and,
people.
You know, and we all knew sooner or later everybody was going to get a record deal, you know, all the good talent.
Yeah.
You know, talent will rise to the top.
Cream always ran, but we all think
exactly.
so.
Exactly, and it did.
It did, especially that time.
And those bands, I mean, you think about it, you know, Butcher's still playing, Sal's still playing, Charlie Farron's still playing. These guys
I think it's what you said before about loving the music. The guys like we are, the guys that last are the guys that appreciate that they're getting paid to do what they enjoy.
No doubt about it, Tony.
Right.
No doubt about it.
They get paid to do what they enjoy doing. And
we were lucky enough. I mean, I was certainly lucky enough that my acts made money.
You were
always good in town. But you know, Howie always made money. Al Goldman made money. Yeah.
This one was
John Stukas.
But I didn't own anything.
Do you know John Stukas? I work with Stukas.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I talk to John once a month.
Nancy was being booked before any of us. She was doing Joan Baez. She changed, what's his name's name?
Nancy worked with Manny.
Yeah, we did the first airplane concert in Boston.
Wow.
Yeah. Nancy was Don Law's first employee, first hire.
Wow.
And then before that, she changed.
I left on when I had Amanda, when I was pregnant.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had just moved to his place on Alewife.
In Cambridge, yeah.
And he had said to me, "I'll set up a nursery for you." Whatever. And I said, "You know what? It's not going to work. I can't book while I'm nursing."
Well, the great Don. I mean, Don was great to me. I have to say, everybody was fearing him. They were fearful. He had too much power.
I didn't roll trucks for me.
But you know what? Two great Don stories. One funny one and one sad one, for me anyway. A friend of mine worked for Don and told me this story, so I can assume it's true. Don is booking Sade.
Yeah.
And he's looking at a contract, and he's in his office looking at the money, and he's freaking out. And apparently, he walked into the main office where everybody was sitting around and said, "What the hell is this? Who the fuck is this Sade person? And why am I paying this band so much money?" He had no idea who the artist was.
Didn't know who Sade was, right? Well, I think that happened a lot.
I think that
did too. Don, when they first had the old tea party upstairs, was fine. Because I did Fleetwood up there, a bunch of stuff up there. And then the Birds, we did the new place. And the Birds, there was nobody there after. I went into his office upstairs, and this is the new place, which is on Lansdowne Street. It's the tea party.
Yeah.
So I went in there, I says, come on, I'm going to have some people give me a hand to load this truck up, you guys, you know. Next thing I know, Don's in the back loading up the truck.
Really? Well, Don called me one day. My office rang. It was like 6 o'clock, maybe. And I answer the phone, and it's Neil. Hold on for Don. I'm like, whoa. So Neil gets back on the phone. He says, are you in your office? I said, yeah. He goes, are you alone? I said, why? He says, Don wants to talk to you, but you have to be alone. Nobody can know about it. And, of course, two people who work for me were sitting right in the office, right? But what am I going to say? No, I can't talk to Don right now, you know. Now, Don never called me one-to-one. But he calls me to ask me if the Stompers are open on this night. I'm like, yeah. Well, I'm going to swear to secrecy, but the Rolling Stones are going to come in and do a club show in Boston.
Yeah.
And I want the Stompers to open.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sitting here going, hubba-da. Yeah. He said, no sound check, you know, but you got to do things by the book. And the first thing is, if this hits the newspaper, they will not play. And I'm like, you know my reputation, you know. You have my solemn word, I will never mention this to anybody, including the band. So that night, there's a meeting at City Hall about the show. Police, you know, all kinds of security, how we're going to do this. And it's in a closed room, and somebody forgot to lock the freaking door. Some clown from Channel 4 gets wind of what's going on and barges into the meeting with a camera and a microphone and screws the whole thing up. So my second call from Don Long the next day was, sorry, Peter, but the show's canceled.
Wow.
I mean, that would have been like the coolest thing in the world.
Oh, man.
And I finally could tell, you know.
And they did the one in Worcester, I think.
And they
that
did
was
the
here.
One, they did in Sir Morgan's Cove.
They were recording that on
that's
Longview.
That's correct.
They come up to the one in the garden after they got busted.
But they've been recording at Longview,
at
right?
At Longview, yeah. That's
and
right.
They went out to do the thing in Worcester.
They went to Sir Morgan's Cove.
Yep.
Which was the greatest club in the world, if you've ever been there. Sir Morgan's Cove had two rooms. One where you could see the band, and one where you couldn't see the band. So, if you paid admission to get in, and you weren't in early enough to be in the room where you could see the band, you were in a room and you couldn't even see the band for the $20 or whatever it was you paid to get in the club. Mm.
Nowadays, you pay more money to be in the room where you couldn't see them.
Very well put, my friend. Very well put.
When me and Chipmunk were kicking footballs in the audience to keep the audience happy because they were stuck in customs. They got busted coming through.
All right, well, we should wrap it up, guys. It's another good hour.
Oh,
with two pints in the corner. We have about 6 pints this morning.
At least 6 pints.
I may go out to lunch and have a couple of pints now.
It's a good one, this.
Yeah, thanks so much, Peter. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
It's been fun.
Incredible stories.
But one thing, we got to get together and not make it so long between hanging out.
Yeah, let's just get together and...
I'll even pay for dinner some night for everybody, okay?
I won't bring Michael Messina.
Yeah. Thanks, John Messina.
John Messina. I just remember him, so, I mean, God, he was a character.
He was a character.
Is he still alive?
I never
forget the first time I saw him at the Channel, because he was a real showman.
Oh, yeah.
On stage, but he only had the two chords down for you can't always get what you want, the Stones cover, and that was like his big number, you know?
I get a phone call from a lawyer. I'm going to tell you one more quick story, because it's a John Messina story, and you'll probably appreciate this. I get a call from a woman lawyer friend of mine who happened to live in Norway, where I'm from. And she said, you know, I'm here. What the hell was the name of that restaurant? It was on Mass Avenue, Newbury Street. It was there for years. Newbury Steakhouse.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here at the Newbury Steakhouse, and I'm having lunch with a guy who I got put in touch with named Mighty Sam McLean. Did you ever hear of him? No. Well, he's from Louisiana, and he
he's friends, you know, with some of the guys down there. In fact, he had no home, you know, and the musicians let him sleep in this rehearsal studio. So it's got to do with me. I don't even know who the guy is. Well, he's looking for a manager. He needs some help. He's living with his girlfriend in Somerville. So is there any chance that, you know, you could join us and, you know, meet him? I said, well, I'm actually right down the street at John Messina's rehearsal studio. So, of course, I walk up to Newbury Street, and I meet her, and I meet Sam, and we go in, and I eat. They had already eaten. So Sam's crying to me how he needs help, and he's got no band, he's got no money, he's living off his girlfriend, and, oh, God, forgive me. I mean, another one, you know? I'm like, well, you know, do you have any gigs anywhere? And he had no gigs. And somehow, I fell in love with the guy. My heart went out to him. So I got his girlfriend's phone number, and I said, I'll call you tomorrow. And basically, I wanted to get together without the lawyer because I didn't use her as my attorney. My attorneys were in New York, and, you know, I had a friend of mine that did work for me here, but it wasn't her. So I got to talk to Sam and figure something out. So I go back to Messina's, and we're sitting in Messina's lounge room. We got the news on, and I'm telling John about meeting this guy from Louisiana, from New Orleans. And I'm saying, I don't know why, but the guy just struck me as being a really interesting cat. We're watching Channel 4 News, and they're interviewing people on the street about busing. And who the hell are they interviewing right in front of the Newbury Steakhouse but Sam McClain, who not only knows nothing about busing, he knows nothing about Boston. Right? And I'm like, if there's ever something sent down from the gods, this was meant to be.
That's a sign, yeah.
Now, we finally got Sam a band, and Sam, you know, played all the local clubs, and he was okay. He was a great performer. I got him a record deal on a small California label called Audio Quest. Mm-hmm. Their deal was, you sign with us, you're a musician, we sell you the CDs for $6 a piece. That cost them $1, and
you sell them for
$20, and that's how you make money. But we don't know anything about radio. We don't know anything about merchandise. Mm-hmm. This is what we do. Because they were, I don't know if you guys, well, you guys are in audio. Audio Quest makes these very, very expensive connecting plugs and stuff people in hi-fi use. So we ended up going up to Woodstock to record his record. Everything they're doing is direct. It's all live. There's absolutely no overdubs.
Yeah.
You know, and we ended up recording the record, you know. But to make matters worse, the day after I'm telling John Messina about meeting this guy and then seeing him on TV, I get a phone call, and he's in the Somerville jail, drunk and disorderly. I'm like going, you know, what am I getting myself into?
Sure.
But he turned out in Europe to be absolutely huge. We went to Europe a dozen times playing festivals, playing, you know.
Yeah.
It was just amazing how popular this guy was. They didn't want white artists, except in England, but they didn't want white artists in France and Belgium.
No, they wanted the real deal.
And Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And I got to travel all over. This is a kid, you know. My parents didn't have 25 cents. I was lucky to take the bus into Boston when I was. So I end up touring Europe several times with Sam and just having a great time with him. He was just an amazing guy. He's dead now, unfortunately, but he ended up, what the hell was the name of that show? Allie McBeal.
Yeah.
His song was the theme song of Allie McBeal
show, yeah.
And he made $250,000.
No, I followed him when you picked him up. Because I got into a lot of blues
and
stuff.
And he pissed every bit of it away. Yeah. He bought a tour bus. For a guy who couldn't get a gig in America, he bought a tour bus.
Yeah.
He hired people. He had valets, you know. I mean, he kind of thought he was James Brown. I was gone from the scene at this point, thank God.
That's a trip. That's great.
But anyways.
Good stories.
That's a good story, Peter.
All good. All good. Thanks for sharing again.
This was great, man. Seeing you two bums, you know, and meeting you, you know.
Two pints in the corner.
There you go, Dinky.
Who came up with that name?
Dinky.
We're having a pint in the corner chatting about the old
days. The corner of the pub talking about the old days.
See, some of the best things come by just...
Just let it go.
Just let it go.
Ah, that's what we do.
That's what we're doing.
Like if I had been watching Channel 7 instead of Channel 4, I never would have heard Sam McClain.
Is that something?
That's how it goes. All right, guys. Wonderful.
Well, thank you,
thanks,
guys.
Peter.
And let's not make it so long next time.